This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from New York City. We'll be heading out to San Francisco this afternoon. In fact, the third hour of our program will be one of our finest programs from the past, the recent past. It's going to be an interesting hour. You'll enjoy it. But I'll be here live for the next 2 hours, and then I'm going to run like a bunny out to the airport to try and catch an airplane. Right now, economic terrorism. Paco Algren is with us. Paco Algren is a financial analyst and author of the new book, Discipline, PACOAHLGREN.com, his website. Paco, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And confirm for me that I'm pronouncing your name right.
You are. You great, are. A lot of great. People pronounce it Paco, and I try to correct them, but
okay.
That works.
Well, great to have you with us. Economic terrorism.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, we're all used to physical terrorism. We've all been through the 9/11 tragedy, and we all, you know, it terrified us, and it certainly changed our lives forever. But a lot of things that people don't pay attention to, a lot of things that people don't understand, that there's a whole underlying facet to this that I think really threatens our way of life even further, and that is economic terrorism, financial terrorism, the idea that the terrorists can and actually have gotten into our financial system and done things that affected their agenda.
Yeah, I am very concerned about this. For example, I think that many Americans right now are terrorized by the fact that the average American family is now $20,000 in debt simply for the cost of George Bush's adventure in Iraq. I mean,
right.
It seems like a terrorist act to me. This cumulative deficit is mind-boggling. The average portion of the U.S. debt is now $30,024.37. The vast majority of that was run up by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and George Bush Jr. It's continuing to increase at the rate of $1.48 billion a day. I don't see, you know, one in five Americans under the age of 65 don't have health insurance. People with incomes of more than $1 million got a tax, you know, got $162,000 apiece from George Bush when he came in with his last tax cut. But he cut $77 billion out of Medicaid and Medicare over the next 5 years and $280 billion over the next 10 years. If this isn't economic terrorism, I don't know what is, Paco.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. I'm no fan or supporter of George Bush, to be certain. I'm a Jeffersonian liberal, and I know that you wrote a book about democracy that had his name in it. And,
yeah.
And I think you and I are very much in accord on a lot of this stuff. I just heard a figure that there's somebody, and I can't remember what the source is, but somebody's estimating that the war on terror, and I'm sorry, the Iraqi war, is going to cost us $1.6 trillion.
Yeah, they're now pushing that to 2.4 now that they're looking at what it's going to cost to take care of these vets for the next 30 years.
Oh, well, that just makes me feel so much better.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it could the average estimate from the CBO this was last week was, you know, $40,000 per American family, 10, 20 years from now we're going to be looking at. But your point, I think your point is well taken. It's just the reason I responded to it in a way that might have sounded glib is I think that it's so important that we start putting things in perspective. George Bush runs around going, America changed on 9/11. Well, on 9/11, you know, 19 guys with box cutters got lucky. But back in 1812, we were invaded by the British and the Canadians who marched to Washington, D.C. and burned down the White House.
Right.
Well, they didn't burn it down, but they burned it. I mean, you know, they gutted it. And it's not like we haven't been attacked before, and it's not like we haven't made it through. So if some guys get into Citibank's computers or Wells Fargo, God forbid, I mean, I don't want to pick on any particular company here, but if they mess with our economic system, isn't the risk from you know, a Bin Laden buddy messing with, you know, crashing the computer of the New York Stock Exchange for a day, really relatively small compared to the risk of China saying that they're going to dump all their U.S. treasuries?
Well, the difference there is that China isn't going to dump their treasuries. I mean, they can say it all day long, but we're their biggest trading partner, and if they dump our treasuries, they're going to pay an enormous price for it, and they know that. I mean, it's a great scare tactic, and I appreciate it. But the thing about that tactic is that it's out in the open. It's something that they've done in the open. It's a chess move, and everybody can see it. The problem with the actual terrorism is that it's clandestine. We don't see it coming. We don't know it's coming, and yes, shutting down the computers at the New York Stock Exchange for a day would be bad, but it wouldn't be catastrophic. But blowing up the New York Stock Exchange, which happens in my book, Discipline, is that could have a ripple effect, just not just financially, but psychologically, that could impact us for years. And I mean, we're talking about something on the magnitude of the 1929 crash, and we definitely don't want to see that. And we know that terrorists have gotten into the system, and we know they've manipulated it. And 9/11, before the planes hit their targets, plane stocks dumped. They went way down, and the government looked into that very carefully because there were a lot of people who knew beforehand that this was going to happen, and they were shorting airline stocks.
Right.
So we know that.
Although I didn't see any reference in the 9/11 Commission report to who those people might be.
Well, I think they probably covered their tracks pretty well. That they definitely, I don't think it was Americans. I think it was people who were privy to what was going to happen.
Interesting. It should have been a flag. I mean, obviously it was. I mean, there were so many flags. But let us not drift into a conversation of 9/11. I think there's a consensus here that's a mess that still is far from untangled. We're talking with Paco Algren, PACOAHLGREN.com, his website. Your new book, Discipline. Paco, I have to apologize. I'm on the road right now, and I don't have your book. Typically, when we have a guest on who's the author of a book, I'll spend, you know, a few hours of the book before we go on the air, if not more. And is this a novel or is this a nonfiction book?
No, it's a novel, but it's based on some very, very real nonfiction elements. It's got it's a very fast-paced thriller, and I wrote it that way because I wanted it to be accessible.
Yeah.
But it touches on a lot of philosophical, political, economic facets, kind of like the things that we've been talking about. Another, an easier way for listeners to get there would be disciplinenovel.com. Both websites, both addresses take you to the same site.
Okay, great. I hope that there's a copy back at the radio station when I get back to Portland. If so, I look forward to reading it.
If there's anybody who I'd like to read it, it would be you. I think, just knowing a lot about your background and what you've done, I think that you would enjoy it a lot.
Well, thank you, Paco. As a financial analyst, as somebody who looks at this kind of stuff for a living, what's your take on what's going on? I mean, you know, here we have, I guess today, oil and gold are down. The world seems to be, the banks seem to be breathing a collective sigh of relief. Many of them are saying, yes, we actually wrote down the actual, harm we're going to have. On the other hand, there's some cautionary notes in today's Financial Times. It seems like a mixed message. The financial newsletters that I've been reading for some months have been saying, you know, look out, gold and oil are going to go up, then there's going to be a correction, they're going to go down in December, and then they're going to go through the roof in January. Obviously nobody knows the future, but, not just from an investment point of view, but also from a, what's going to happen in the world point of view, what happens if Pakistan melts down. What are your thoughts about what's going on, and what are your thoughts about what's the best way for Americans to prepare themselves personally and financially? We have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes here, I think, before we have to wrap this up.
Sure. Well, I watch CNBC constantly all day long. I mean, I'm watching this, and every time that you see somebody say the markets are going to shatter, there's somebody else who's coming in who's going to say that, you know, the Dow Jones is going to 20,000, and there's no shortage of arguments on both sides. The dollar is weak. The dollar has collapsed against the euro and other major currencies, and you know, I think our government knows why it's doing it, what it's doing. The price of oil is artificially high, I think. I think that this is a demand-driven oil market rather than a supply-driven oil market in the 70s, but it doesn't matter really what's driving it. In 1980 or 1979, we know what the Saudis did. They opened the tap, and the price of oil went from about $40 a barrel to $9 a barrel. It's going to happen again, and when it does, things are going to change. As far as what Americans can do to prepare, I think that really involves us going to the polls more than anything else. I mean, people talk about buying assets, buying gold, buying euros. I'm not a big advocate of that. I think that it's much smarter to talk about changing the form of government. And like I said, I'm a Jeffersonian. I believe in a smaller federal government. And I think that's really where our problem is right now. Mm. There's a huge, bloated federal government.
Interesting. Okay, Paco Agron and Discipline Novel.
DisciplineNovel.com.
.com, the website. Paco, thanks for dropping by.
Tom, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
As we celebrate mediocrity, our boys upstairs want to see how much you'll pay for what you used to get for free. And there goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play. He says what he wants to say. Hey, hey, hey. And there goes your freedom of choice. And there goes the last human voice.
And welcome back. Some interesting news today. You take an overview of what's going on in the world, and it's remarkable. You know, I'm an advocate of tariffs, saying, you know, let's have a tariff-based trade policy where we say, you know, there are some products that we really don't want imported into the United States that we actually want made here. In some cases, because of national security. In some cases, because it's best for our economy. In some cases, it's because it's best for our jobs, for our working people. This is how we did it for 200 years in the United States. It's how most countries still do it. And today's Financial Times, page 2, Europe will use tariffs in subsidy fight with China. Europe, this Andrew Bounds in Brussels, Europe is to reinforce its tougher line against China by following the U.S. and slapping tariffs on Chinese products that benefit from alleged subsidies. And what they're saying is that, you know, China's products are subsidized because they're holding the yen down, or the yuan down, rather, because it's not a free market, in quotes. You know, there's still a lot of central control, and a lot of subsidy, and so they're saying we're gonna do something about this. We're gonna use tariffs. Why not use tariffs more broadly? You know, rather than just to defend the interests of multinational corporations who are hurt by China's competition, which is really what this is talking about. Why not use tariffs to defend our nations? And the article goes on to say, biggest policy change to emerge from a year-long review of the EU's trade defense instruments, Peter Mandelson, the trade commissioner, is to propose to allow the commission to start anti-subsidy actions itself. And then they go on to that. So just wanted to toss that out. I think it's an interesting one. Another one, this is particularly startling in that going through the American papers this morning, and maybe they were there and I missed them. I read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times this morning, and then read most of the sites online. And the only place I found this was in the British press, in the Financial Times. Californian vote switch may bolster Republicans. And this is the California Counts campaign. It's being funded by Daryl Issa, in part, the congressman who funded the campaign to get Gray Davis replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Other funders include, they've already raised $2 million from backers. Other backers include Floyd Gvadne, K-V-A-M-M-E, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, a Silicon Valley venture firm. And Robert Day, who has given money to Mrs. Clinton, is backing the initiative, it says. And what this initiative would do, basically, is it would say that every congressional district in California will send their own elector to the Electoral College. And the bottom line is that instead of California as a whole voting for a Democrat or Republican, all of the electoral votes going into the total, you know, as much as half of California's electoral votes could be chopped off. In fact, the Democrats are saying probably about 22 of their electoral votes they would lose. That's a number of electoral votes that, I mean, this is not inconsequential, that is equal to Nevada, Utah, and New Mexico. It's actually more than the combined total of those three states. So if those three states went Democratic, it wouldn't matter. California would reverse it. And the first time this was being promoted was by friends of Rudy Giuliani. Now it's being promoted by Daryl Issa. This is the serious Republican, we're going to have the Republican majority forever folks. And in a close election, in a close race, if this thing gets on the ballot in California, and if it is passed, I mean, it sounds like a really appealing idea, right? My congressional district elector is going to vote the way I want to vote. And if it was passed all across the United States, it actually probably would be a good idea. But when you've got all but two other states in the union saying, you know, doing winner-take-all states, what this will do is throw a huge advantage since throw a huge advantage to the Republicans, basically, because California is a reliably blue state, and it'll turn it from blue to half blue, half red. It's like giving an entire another 22 electoral votes is huge. Vermont only has three. I mean, Oregon has, I think, what, seven, eight, nine, something in that neighborhood. 22 electoral votes. We're talking a lot. Will suddenly go into the Republican category. Almost certainly. Now, there is what's called the National Popular Vote Campaign, which both parties support. And so far, a couple of states have signed on to this, Maryland and Illinois. But it says that when 25 states with an aggregate majority of electoral votes have signed on, then those states, then a law kicks in where all the states basically do this, where the electors are chosen at the level of the congressional district. And as I said, I think that's a great idea if you're doing the entire country. But this is a very strategic move by the Republicans in California. They have 200,000 votes, or they have 200,000 signatures already on the to get it on the ballot. They're only 40,000 signatures short. It's probably going to make it to the ballot. This is the secret weapon. I mean, not to mention that they're still caging and they still have the voting machines and all everything else. But this is the major secret weapon that the Republicans are relying on to take the White House in 2008. 27 minutes past the hour. Well, no, actually, there's a lot you can do. Remember back before Bush invaded Iraq, and there's all one of the big marching oil for food thing is a scam, and Saddam is running this scam, and there's these Korean companies, and there's these maybe some of the old former Soviet states, some nasty guys out there doing this, and another reason to take out Saddam because it's just the bad guys. Well. Again, the headline in today's Financial Times, Chevron pays $30 million in Iraq bribes case. Chevron, the second largest U.S. oil company, yesterday agreed to pay a $30 million settlement after acknowledging bribes were paid for oil it obtained under the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iran. Yeah. Yeah. Yesterday, one of our conversations, a question arose. You know, where are the young people? And I've gotten several emails from folks about that. You know, in the protests and things. And one of the most articulate came from a young man by the name of Jared. He says, "I heard you and a caller wondering why young people aren't on the streets. As a young person, I can assure you there are lots of us who would like to. The problem is we can't afford to. So many of us have tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt from our education." Jobs that we can't count on being there for us next month, let alone next year. We have insurance we can barely afford, medical costs skyrocketing out of control. We want to go out in March, but we don't have the advantages that the baby boom generation in the 60s had. We don't have affordable education. We don't have affordable health care. We don't have reliable jobs. I know that once I find a permanent job with reliable health insurance, I'll get more involved than I already do, or than I already am. But, well said, Jared. He says, thanks for all you do, and even if you don't respond directly to this email, I'm sure you'll read it and consider. Yeah, I did, and thank you, and well said. David Turr, a Ph.D. from UC Berkeley, who does political analysis, This is from the PR web. This is interesting. We have almost 250 polls involving a hypothetical election between Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton, and she is consistently performing worse than Edwards in those same polls. I think what's so fascinating about this is, you know, last night I'm staying here in the city with my friend Jerry, and we were watching last night, I'm not sure which show it was. It was one of the MSNBC shows, and they had on, it might have been Chris Matthews, had on David Gregory and the White House correspondent and John King, a CNN correspondent, and I think it was Gloria Borger and Chris Matthews, as I recall. And the question was, who's the most electable? And they were all talking about how, well, everybody knows Hillary Clinton's the most electable of the Democrats. Well, I would submit to you that everybody knows that because the media keeps telling us that, because that's who big business in America wants as their candidate. But this analyst says they argue that Hillary performs worse because of polls of independents and moderates who find her objectionable and have vowed to never support her regardless of circumstance. John Edwards does not suffer from such objection when critical, which is critical in a close election, says David Turr. So at the risk of sounding partisan, you know my preferences. And as I've said, if Hillary is the nominee of the party, I will support her. But I am very concerned that we are being set up and that this is not a road that the Democrats should go down, and that we're being set up, frankly, by a media that has its own interests in this whole thing. Kate, Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, first I want to say that my son is going to be in Redwood City tomorrow having you sign a book for me.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Definitely. The reason I called was to say that your guest inadvertently said something that's been bothering me since 9/11, and that is he said something like, things have changed forever, on 9/11.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a meme that there's nobody to say how things have changed. Someone, maybe you can be more articulate than I
to me, it's nonsense and gibberish. And,
yeah.
and my guest, oddly, had a rather right-wing news release and about terrorism and they're coming to get us. And then, you know, I say, but what about the terrorists here? And he's like, I totally agree with you. And at that point, you know, what do you do?
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
What does that mean? You know, is it, does someone say, I mean, what changed? How did it change? Seems to me that what has changed, someone who's making that pronouncement, not that he was really heavy on that, it's just, it's been out there for years. Things have changed from being focus on the Constitution to focus on fear and security worries,
yeah,
et cetera.
I think that we could arguably say that there have been a number of turning points in American history. Watergate, for example, was one of them. The assassination of Jack Kennedy was one of them. I think that we could all agree, even conservatives would agree, that the assassination of Jack Kennedy changed America forever, that the unseating of Richard Nixon changed America forever. In small and subtle ways, you know, relatively speaking, but it did change our political discourse. It did change the way we view ourselves as a nation. And I think 9/11 changed us in a certain way. The problem is not the change. I mean, we can go back and we can probably find, you know, 40 of them in just the 20th century. World War I, World War II, the Sedition Acts that Woodrow Wilson passed during World War I, the internment of the Japanese by subsets of World War II, for example, by Roosevelt. Certainly the passage of Social Security changed America forever in 1936. The passage of the Wagner Act, so people could unionize in 1935, changed America forever. There's no shortage of them.
Yes, yeah, so the implication in that statement, there's something implied there. That,
yeah, which is that we all need to be afraid now.
Yes.
And therefore surrender to authority.
Yes.
And it's just, and you're absolutely right, Kate, and thank you for calling and for highlighting that. It's a good point, and it reminds me of a story that is in today's Daily Mail, the UK newspaper. This is pretty mind-boggling. See, I mean, is this the road we're going down? Big Brother, you'll recall, the invention of George Orwell. That he was British, and 1984, the novel takes place in presumably in England. And England has more surveillance cameras than any other per capita than any other country in the world. It is the most watched, observed, listened to, spied on society in the world on a per capita basis. I mean, it's It's startling when you think about it. Well, probably Burma is more, well, they don't have the technology there, though, see? And now, travelers face price hikes and confusion after the government unveiled plans to take up to 53 pieces of information from anyone leaving or entering Britain. This is by James Slack in today's Daily Mail. For every journey, anytime you want to fly someplace, security officials will want credit card details, holiday contact numbers, travel plans, email addresses, car license plates, and even any previously missed flights. This information taken when a ticket is bought will be shared among police, customs, immigration, and security services for at least 24 hours before a journey is due to take place. And they go on to talk about how if you have an outstanding fine, a speeding penalty, you can be barred from leaving the country, even if you pose no security risk. These are called the e-border system. Gordon Brown announced this. I thought Gordon Brown was a reasonably decent guy. I'm just astounded by this. They're saying it's going to cost over $1.2 billion. Critics are concerned that this is going to clog things up. I don't hear anybody saying, hey, whatever happened to privacy? Whatever happened to they don't have a Fourth Amendment in England. I mean, you know, privacy is apparently not that big a deal. But this is just amazing. In fact, they talk about ministers are also considering the creation of a list of disruptive passengers so that authorities know in advance of a potential troublemaker such as an abusive drunk. So if you've been arrested for drunk driving, you're going to be flagged at the airport. And they're going to give you a breathalyzer? Is this? I mean, how weird is this going to get? And when is it going to come here? Well, it'll come here if Giuliani becomes president, I'm telling you. Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank.
Hi there. I'd like to, and I love your show, but I'd like to respectfully disagree with you regarding why Hillary is ahead. And the corporations may well be supporting her for all the obvious reasons, but there's a very interesting article in yesterday's New York Times. I don't know if you had a chance. And what they're seeing on both sides, both red and blue, is that people are pushing pragmatism, the electorate, over idealism at this time.
Yeah, I read that article. Well, actually, the conclusion of the article was that many primary voters are very, very concerned about the issues, and it seemed to me that the article was suggesting that there's some kind of a balance there. But here's the problem, Frank. If when you actually look at the polls, where they actually, and the Zogby polls are out there, I mean, you can look at them, where they say, Rudy Giuliani versus Hillary Clinton, how would you vote? Rudy Giuliani versus John Edwards, how would you vote? Rudy Giuliani versus Barack Obama, how would you vote? Mitt Romney versus Clinton, Mitt Romney versus, you know, when you look at those polls, what you find is that the Democrat who most consistently will be able and has for the better part of a year now, will be able to beat any named Republican is John Edwards. And yet that is not being reported in the mainstream press. Instead, they're all saying that Hillary is the one who's the most electable. And that's how I define electability, as the ability to beat the other guy.
But I would suggest to you, and I come from a family, I grew up in a political family, what idealism versus pragmatism is an inverse ratio to how near you are to the election.
But see, John Edwards has already, I mean, he beat the Jesse Helms machine in South Carolina running for the Senate. I mean, he took on a huge political machine and beat it. Hillary Clinton was facing no-name candidates in New York State, and Barack Obama went up against Alan Keyes, who didn't even bother to move to Illinois to run against him. I mean, John Edwards actually ran for vice president on the ticket and won, in my opinion. And if he didn't win, it was certainly by a hair's whisker. I think it was stolen in Ohio, but even if they didn't win, he knows how to run a presidential campaign. He's been there and been successful. I don't see that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama have any substantial electoral successes against serious opposition ever.
And I hope you're right. I mean, I am not a Hillary backer.
Yeah, I'm just saying I don't get it where the press is coming up with this. You know, she's the presumptive nominee. She's the most electable. When you look at the objective evidence, number one, the polls show that she's not the most elected. She's not the most likely to beat a Republican, and that's, I think, one of the definitions of electability. And number two, that, you know, she's never taken on a really serious candidate. I mean, there was talk about Giuliani was going to run against her for the Senate. That would have been a race, but the Republicans basically threw it away both times. Interesting. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
But I'm just talking to a satellite.
And this modern world is allowing us to do so many extraordinary things. Mike Papantonio, running ringoffireradio.com, Ring of Fire here on Air America Radio, as well as goleft.tv, all kinds of cool stuff. Plus, he's out there fighting for the little guy. It's just remarkable. Mike, welcome to the program.
How are you, Tom?
I am
good
marvelous.
Show. I've been listening in. Another good show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Pap, over the last 20 years, the pharmaceutical industry has given $100 million to Republicans.
Yeah.
Merck alone, $2 million to Republicans. This seems to be helping them somewhat when it comes to things like Vioxx. Tell us about this and your thoughts, your involvement.
Yeah, there's a direct formula here to how the pharmaceutical... Well, first of all, the formula begins with the Republican agenda. Grover Norquist, when he said that he wanted to make sure that we could make government so small that we could drown it in a bathtub, that the FDA is a product of the Grover Norquist Republican mentality. And what's happened, Merck is just one example. We were able to finalize Merck, and I think it's a strong, good settlement for the people.
Hang on just a second. By we, you mean your law firm was involved?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. We did all the national discovery on Merck.
Oh, that's great. Merck, and by finalize, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, finally, Merck understands that, yeah, they've won 12 cases, but it's just like any pharmaceutical case, we're going to start winning them.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that happen in the last several cases. And this isn't because they're being nice, folks. I mean, this company does nothing because they're being nice about it. It was a good business decision for them to make it go away. I mean, this is a company that averages $4 to $5 billion a year in net profit. So it's not anything that really changes. It's barely a blip on the screen.
Yeah.
But if I look at this case, Tom, it's the same formula that we see in virtually all of these pharmaceutical cases, whether it's Baycol, Fenfen, Rezlin, Fedra, Celebrex, whatever it is. It works like this. First, you create a need for a product with direct marketing. I mean, they spent the industry spends $4 billion a year advertising directly to people, telling them that, there's some mystical, magical pill that will make them sleep better and have better sex or, have no less heart, whatever it is.
Right.
They sell it through this direct marketing that we should stop immediately.
It used to be illegal.
Should be illegal. Most countries, it's illegal because you basically have the patient telling the doctor what they need.
Yeah, it was illegal here for a long time.
I don't remember
when it changed, though. I noticed one day it had changed.
Well,
I don't remember when that was.
It happened quietly, and it happened quietly after the industry had moved a ton of money into political campaigns that, to get those votes.
But this is like in the last 20 years or so.
Yes, yes. But it's the same, the pharmaceutical company's always been the people with the money, and they're go-to people in political campaigns because they'll always deliver big money. So first what you do is you create the need. The next thing that you do is that you spend more money marketing than you do on double-blind safety studies, clinical studies. If you look at the ratio between actual clinical studies to direct marketing, it's 20-1, where they spend 20 times as much money marketing than they do actually studying the product. And then this formula holds true with Merck. I mean, if you look at the next thing that Merck does, and that not just Merck, Pfizer, Glaxo, whoever it is, whatever the drug du jour of the day, whatever the drug of the day is, they have the same formula they put in place. The next thing is they get inside bureaucrats that they say, look, we're going to give you a job if you come, if you do what we want you to do, we're going to give you a job when you come out.
Mm-hmm.
And they make promises to these people. They're not really regulators. It's really captive regulatory process. They capture the bureaucracy. They capture these regulators and they make them basically work for the industry. And so then after you do that, the next thing that you do is if anybody speaks up, if any of those bureaucrats say, look, this isn't right, what you do is you attack those bureaucrats. You make a few phone calls to your trick monkey congressman and you say, look, this bureaucrat is not cooperating. Can you do something about him? And you put pressure on that honorable but uncooperative bureaucrat. And then it continues even beyond that. After you attack the bureaucrat, you then attack the medical doctors who are actually using the product, and they're saying that the product is killing people in the field. And then you attack that doctor by having their hospital privileges revoked or discrediting and embarrassing them.
The doctors who out this.
Doctors who say this is wrong, we've
right.
got to get it off the market. We've
yeah.
even had cases in the past where the doctor's family was threatened for him speaking up.
Wow.
If you take a look at the movie Michael Clayton, it's a movie out there that it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of tells the story. It really tells the George Clooney does a good job understanding how corrupt this industry really is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but if you look at every one of these cases, Tom, they all have the same formula. And the last part of the formula is, destroy all the documents. Once somebody finds out that you're doing wrong, destroy the emails, destroy the inter-office memos, destroy the documents, and then you have a drug that most of the time is not needed. It's a drug that's not efficacious most of the time. It's a drug that's not safe most of the time. It's a drug that's not been completely tested most of the time. And you have that product on the market where the risk benefit is, it's not even a reasonable risk benefit, that simply is a cash cow.
Right.
We saw that with Baycol. We saw it with Finfin. We saw it with Reslin, with Ephedra, with Vioxx, with Celebrex, Accutane. Accutane is killing kids. I mean, Accutane is a drug that right now kids are still taking for acne.
Right.
There are all kinds of alternatives to it, but they're taking it for acne. And what it's doing is giving them Crohn's disease and a whole host of gastrointestinal problems.
Holy cow. Holy cow. Mike, I would like to get you back on the program and ask the question, if John Edwards is the nominee, they're going to go after him as a trial lawyer, you know, what you are, and your profession on the line or under attack. I'd love to get into
Let's
conversation.
Let's talk about it. Edwards is a good friend.
We'll schedule that down the road.
All right.
Pap, thanks so much. Mike Papantonio, ringoffire.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from New York. Tomorrow we'll be in San Francisco. I'll be doing the show live from Green 960. And that afternoon, tomorrow afternoon, Friday afternoon, 3:30 to 6 p.m. It's Friday, November 16th. I'll be doing giving a speech and doing a book signing at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. Should be great fun. Pilgrim's Way Bookstore on Saturday in Carmel, California, Saturday the 17th. So check that out. And as I mentioned, the third hour of our program today is going to be a best of hour, as I have to run like a bunny through the rain here in New York to get out to the airport to catch a flight to San Francisco. Myron Abell is with us. He is the Director of Energy Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, somebody who's been a guest many times in this program, CEI.org, Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website. Myron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you. Thank you. And I hope all is well with you as well.
Yes.
You're promoting the idea that if we simply opened ANWR and did more aggressive offshore drilling, but in particular went after the oil up at the around the Arctic Circle, and I'm assuming now that the Arctic is opening up with all this loss of ice up there, whether or not it's global warming, it would be even more up there, that this will make us energy independent in 10 years. Do I get that right?
Well, I don't know that I've made any strong claims about deadlines or anything, but I do think, and I don't know that I think that the mining or oil production in the North Pole region is practical yet, and it may never be. Who knows? But I do think that if we're concerned about the price of oil and the problems in the world in many of the places where oil is produced, and also concerned about the inability or incompetence of some of the petrostates to actually effectively develop their own and manage their own oil resources, like in Venezuela, where I think Chavez is destroying his industry through incompetent management.
His economy is growing faster than ours is.
Yeah, but I think in the long term it looks pretty bad for their oil industry. But if you agree with any of those things, then I think you ought to consider that if we need more oil and we want the price to be lower for gasoline, we ought to be drilling and producing more of our own energy here.
Well, why would we want more oil and have the prices be lower for gasoline when the cost in human terms from cancers as a consequence of the exhaust coming out of cars? Because gasoline is such a dirty fuel. I mean, it's basically about a third of gasoline is waste products from oil. Ethanol, on the other hand, doesn't produce those.
Biodiesel, by and large, doesn't produce those other than some small amounts of particulate matter. Why would we want to be encouraging that? And not to mention global warming, which I know you don't think that it's being caused by that. So that, which is why I didn't even bring that up in the first place. But the practical stuff of our, you know, our reliance on a fossil fuel. I mean, this is literally stuff that was made 300 to 500 million years ago. There's a finite amount of it. Even if we open up all those fields, you know, in 1860, from Pennsylvania to Michigan was a giant oil field, and they were pumping it like crazy. It's all dry now. And, you know, why go after another 10 years, another 20 years, another 30 years when there's going to be a limit? And do it with a fuel that is killing us.
Well, I think you raise good points. And I would say this. I think that there will clearly be a transition away from the fossil fuels at some point in the future. However, they are very good fuels. They concentrate a lot of energy in a very small amount of liquid volume that petroleum does. And, you know, I think you exaggerate the health effects. If you burn gasoline in an engine that doesn't have any of the modern technology, yes, it's a dirty fuel. But if you look at it today, you can see that the typical automobile sold in the United States is extremely clean.
Yeah, but I don't have the study right in front of me, but I'm sure you're familiar with this, Myron. That, you know, just in the last year or two, there have been a number of good science studies done that show the rate of asthma in children is a linear relationship, and maybe it's even a log relationship, between how close they live to a major artery or a highway.
I do not think those are good studies, and I think if you look at the wider literature, you'll see that the rates of asthma in the United States have been going up as the air and the environment in general has been getting much cleaner. The countries that don't have much asthma or have lower rates are the countries that are still using very dirty technologies and are very poor.
Because those people are dying off?
Well, no. I don't know what causes asthma.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably several different things. But clearly, our air pollution, our air quality has been getting much better over the last
generally speaking, but again, those people who live near highways, those people who are inhaling tailpipe fumes all day long, I mean, just common sense would tell you. It's almost like you're arguing that smoking doesn't cause disease. I mean,
I'm not arguing that.
This stuff is dirty. It's got known carcinogens in it.
There isn't much coming out of a tailpipe anymore other than...
There's a fair amount of benzene. We've got 30 times more benzene in Portland than they do in California because they put it in our gasoline to get rid of it because California banned it.
Right. But I do think, to go back to your question about alternative fuels, I don't have anything against any of these alternative fuels, except that they have many problems themselves. I think you have to compare not only the pluses of these fuels but the minuses.
And half of all the cars in Brazil are running on ethanol or biodiesel. In Germany, 10 years ago, they passed a law requiring every gas station to have a biodiesel pump, and now it's ubiquitous. It's all over the country. It's the cheapest form of fuel. Everybody's moving to diesel vehicles there.
It's cheaper
here. The oil companies refuse to put the pumps in.
Well, look, the problem, just very simply, the problem with ethanol, there are three of them. First, it takes a huge amount of land, it takes a huge amount of fertilizer, and it takes a huge amount of water to grow all the fuel.
It depends on the plant that you're using. I mean, you know, if you wanted to get biodiesel from hemp or if you want to get ethanol from sugar cane, no, not so much. But I agree. Yeah. There are going to be trade-offs. Let's get back to Anwar, because that's where we started with this thing.
Yeah. Well, let me just say one more thing about ethanol. There's a huge petroleum input to produce a gallon of ethanol.
Yeah, I know.
Why the oil companies have stopped really fighting the ethanol mandates, because they said, well, yeah, it'll increase gasoline.
Yeah, as long as it's done with corn, and you got the corn lobby and you got ADM and all that stuff. And I get all that.
Right.
I'm wondering if you're familiar with the name Daniel Carson Lewis of Living Good Alaska.
No.
Okay. This, I think, is the strongest argument against why we should be drilling in Anwar.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This guy is a hunter and a drunk. And he was out hunting while drunk in Alaska with a .338 caliber rifle, and he put a single bullet through the Trans-Alaskan oil pipeline. This thing spewed 285,600 gallons of oil, 75 feet in the air, saturated the tundra. It was blowing this out for 3 days as they were trying to fix this leak. And one of the local cops who was interviewed about this, he says, no, this guy isn't a terrorist. It was just somebody being stupid with their gun. Alcohol and a guy with a gun. Nothing deeper than that. Well, is that supposed to be reassuring? I mean, here we got a drunk in Texas, or in Alaska, capable of shutting down basically the Alaskan oil pipeline for 3 days, and, you know, with a single hunting rifle, and you want to have more of our, you know, the lifeblood of this nation flowing through that kind of very, very vulnerable infrastructure?
Well, I think, you know, there have been several incidents like that, but over the entire course of the history of the pipeline, which is, you know, really one of the engineering marvels of the modern world, it has sent a huge amount of oil into this country and onto the world market, and it has done a tremendous amount of good with very, very few problems. So, yes, there's one guy who's plonked it.
Yeah, last month. But you know, the point is, I mean, I suspect that you're concerned about terrorists.
Well,
you know, one stick of dynamite, it's not going to take much to take out a pipeline.
Well, yeah, but pipelines, you can take it out in one spot and it can be rebuilt pretty quickly. It doesn't wreck the whole pipeline.
Okay, 30 sticks of dynamite in 30 different places. I mean, we're still talking about something that can be done by three people in a pickup truck. This doesn't even require hijacking an airplane.
Well, you know, I'd have to see a little more evidence that it's likely to happen, Tom.
So you don't think that the United States has any kind of terrorist threat?
Yes, but I don't think you find a lot of it up in the
Alaska.
North slope of Alaska.
Okay. All righty. Myron Abel, he's the Director of Energy Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, the website. Myron, always great talking with you. Thanks for coming.
Great. Have a good day.
You too. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
There's no business like oil business, like no business I know. Everything about it is so thrilling. Buying up the Congress, Mr. Quell. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does blow. Withholding technology, they know it's oil. OPEC stranglehold on the oil. They only care that their earnings do not fall, so their profits will grow.
No business like oil business, yes. And look at what's being used with the money that you're putting in the pump. As the old saying goes, when you're driving alone, you're driving with Osama. Or when you're driving an SUV, you're driving with Osama. Well, maybe not Osama so much anymore because he's not getting money from Saudi Arabia. Although, maybe he is. In all probability, he is. We know certainly a lot of the Sunnis in Iraq who are shooting at us are getting money from Saudi Arabia. But just Saudi Arabia itself. 19-year-old woman. This is from Agence France-Presse, AFP. 19-year-old woman in Saudi Arabia was gang raped by six men because she was in a car with an unrelated man, which is a crime in Saudi Arabia. For any woman to be in a car without a relative, without a male relative with her, because she was in a car without a related man, she was ordered to undergo 90 lashes. And lashing in Saudi Arabia is not some small thing. This is not, you know, just here. This is serious stuff. You end up with your back all bleeding and skin ripped off and scarred for life, and it hurts like hell. And it can break ribs. It can cause physical deformities. 90 lashes is the penalty that she was given for being gang raped by these six guys who essentially claimed as justification that she was in a car without a relative protecting her, and therefore she was fair game. Now, the six guys were, five of the six guys were busted, and they were also sent to jail. They were sent to jail for a year. But the woman's lawyer, she hired, her lawyer is a guy named Abdul Rahman El Lahem. If I'm, I don't know if the ch is pronounced in Saudi Arabian Arabic. I don't think it is, actually. I think it's, that's more the Hebrew pronunciation. So anyhow, it would be Abdul Rahman El Lahem. He decided to talk about this in the press. Now, this is wrong, that this woman who's gang raped is getting 90 lashes. And so the court said, okay, we'll reconsider this. And they did. And they decided to raise the number of lashes from 90 to 200 because she had, quote, attempted to aggravate and influence the judiciary through the media because her lawyer had talked to the press. She is now facing 200 lashes. Welcome to Saudi Arabia, the country that we built with our oil. I know, not, obviously not just us, but your oil dollars at work, my friend. So, you know, yeah, Myra Nobel is absolutely right. We need to get off, we need to become energy independent. But doing it by pumping more oil through a pipeline that a drunk with it. With a 338 rifle can take out? I don't think so. I just don't think so. I'm sorry. Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve, what's up? What's on your mind today?
Well, hey, Tom. I love your show. I just wanted to mention, I used to work on the pipeline up in on the North Slope, mm-hmm. and I've been around Alaska, and I've seen the pipeline itself. It comes right down to the highway, and it goes to Valdez. And it's totally unprotected. I mean, you're absolutely right. Anybody could shoot it on purpose or by accident.
As happened on October 4th last month. Yeah.
There's a fence around it. But other than that, it's like 800 miles, you know, so it's pretty hard to have tight security around the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so really that's basically all I wanted to comment on. You're right about that. But also this story about the Saudi Arabian woman, that's just horrible. It reminds me of the conservative guy who wrote the book recently, a few months back. It was talking about how it's liberals' fault for imposing our culture on these Arabic cultures, and that's why we have terrorism. And, you know, to me that's like he's advocating the Saudi Arabian culture, like we should be more like them, you know.
Yeah, well, and nobody's suggesting, frankly, I'm not suggesting that we should impose our culture on them. I do think, though, that there are certain standards of decency and humanity that are acknowledged all over the world, and this does
Absolutely.
Not comport with them, frankly. There's large parts of Islam and many sects within Islam that would repudiate this immediately. But this is the Wahhabists. These are the right wingers. This is the equivalent of the Pat Robertson wing of Islam that has you know control in Saudi Arabia. Steve, thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And by the way, just a, you know, shameless promotion here. Actually, it's kind of a cool thing. Powell's Bookstores, this is the last week that they're offering a 35% discount on Cracking the Code online and in the bookstores. But online all across the United States, Powell's.com. a 35% discount. And tomorrow I'll be at Green 960 AM in San Francisco. We'll be doing the show live from the radio station. And then that afternoon, tomorrow afternoon, Friday afternoon, the 16th of November, from 3:30 to 6 p.m. at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. You do need tickets. So you go to green960.com and get your tickets there. On Saturday, November 17th, Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California, with KRXA. We're doing two book signings there. And then at the end of the month in L.A., the 29th, I'll be in at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica. Looking forward to that. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. There is, and just before I get to that, speaking of energy and speaking of dirty energy, this is fascinating. Tonight's CNN, you know, there's going to be a presidential debate tonight on CNN, 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Guess who's sponsoring this thing? The so-called clean coal industry. Now, let me just go on record as saying there is no such thing as clean coal. In order to liquefy coal, first of all, it consumes mind-boggling amounts of water, which is becoming a very scarce resource, and it consumes enormous amounts of energy. It liquefying coal, I mean, this is Hitler tried to do this during World War II because he was running out of oil. It can be done, but it produces twice the global warming pollution, twice the carbon dioxide, as does gasoline, if you're going to use this stuff to fuel vehicles. This industry also has as one of their major agendas to get as many new power plants built as possible using coal. Well, you know, obviously, I mean, it's profitable to them. 150 new coal-fired power plants on the drawing board right now. They have been working aggressively to chop down and weaken and cut back on carbon dioxide pollution limits. And they're trying to put this cap-and-trade program into place where Congress, they're lobbying very aggressively for Congress to give them free allowances, is what they call it, to emit greenhouse gases, rather than having to at least buy these things at auction. And there's some speculation that one of the reasons why they're sponsoring this debate is to lean on Harry Reid, because he obstructed, really, you know, blocked the three proposed major coal-fired power plants in Nevada. Harry Reid is absolutely opposed to this, you know, not in his backyard anyway. So here we have the clean coal industry going to be sponsoring this debate tonight. It'll be very interesting to see if Wolf Blitzer is willing to bite the hand that feeds him the coal industry and ask the Democratic presidential candidates whether they support so-called clean coal, end quote, and then to hear what they have to say about it. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, Greg in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
You brought up the thing about where are the young people?
Yeah, yesterday, actually.
Okay, well, I thought I was just listening.
No, I mentioned it again this morning. You're right.
Right, yeah, right.
Or this afternoon.
And, the thing is, I see it. Well, I work for a large company, but I'm not actually an employee. I'm an outsourced employee.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making a ton of money off this stinking occupation. But most of the people I work with are completely oblivious to what's going on. They have no clue of what's going on in the political world. And then on the other hand, the ones that do, which are like me, are scared to lose our jobs because we're not actually full-time employees. We're actually outsourced in that place.
Right.
And
you're contractor.
That job.
What are they calling it? It's the contractors.
Right.
Yeah,
and this is for a multi-billion dollar company that I work for, and I don't have, like I don't have days off. I don't have sick days. I don't have, you know, I mean, I had forced weeks off because of holidays. So I can't make that. I can't go out and make a public statement about, you know, like on my desk I have, at my workstation I have anti-Bush stuff, you know, and I get looked down on because of it, you know.
Yeah.
Plus the young people there, I mean, they just don't get it.
Yeah.
And the ones that do, they're like, hey, you know, well, we're lucky to have a job. So that's where I think, like, the young people that are out there, you know, the ones that are really have any kind of mind to them of what's going on, they're the ones that are going, you know, I can't afford to lose my job.
Right. They're pedaling as fast as they can, and they're not climbing the hill. They're slipping backwards.
Exactly.
To use a metaphor.
Right, and then the young people have bought into this thing, hey, you know, corporatism is good because someday I'm going to get to the top. And I'm going, hey, I've been out in the world doing this for 20-something years, and I haven't gotten anywhere, and you're going to be lucky to get somewhere, too, unless your mom and dad is going to help you get in this position or you're going to kiss a lot of tail, you know?
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, everybody thinks they're going to start the next Google. So, but frankly, actually, I don't think that that's the main thing. And Greg, thanks for the call, and good point. I don't think that the main thing is that people think that the people are identifying with the rich, thinking that someday they'll get rich or hoping that someday they'll get rich. I think it's just, as you pointed out, A, they're uninformed, and we can thank Reagan and his purge of civics classes from our public schools in the 1980s, and not just, I mean, you know, not just Ronald Reagan, the entire conservative movement, and David Horowitz carrying on that fine tradition in our college campuses today. We can thank them. And we can thank the fact that the average worker now is scared to death. I mean, they're just absolutely scared to death. Faith in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Faith.
Oh, hi.
You're...
How are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Good. So I wanted to thank you for your endorsement of Edwards. My boyfriend and I are going out to Iowa to campaign for him. We're leaving Philadelphia on December 31st, going to spend New Year's there and do some canvassing in Ames, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to let your callers and your listeners know how easy it is to just call up Iowa, and they are welcoming volunteers with open arms.
Are you the person that I met in Philadelphia
yes.
on Monday night? Oh, that's
yes.
great. I'm so glad you called in, Faith. And first of all, let me just, for the record, I haven't formally endorsed any candidate, but I do believe that John Edwards is the best of the Democratic pack in terms of his policies, his positions, and his ability to get elected and beat a Republican. That's my firm conviction, and I may yet endorse somebody, and it would probably be him. But you know, I have also said, whoever the nominee is, I will support. But you're going out to canvass for Edwards in Iowa, and I think that's extraordinary. You did that back for Howard Dean 4 years ago, and you learned some lessons from that. You were telling me about Monday night.
Yeah, I believe Dean made some mistakes out there. The first one being that we were told as canvassers to go out there with an anti-war message, which at the time didn't go over well in Iowa at all. This was 2004. Many Iowans know someone personally who's fighting in Iraq.
Right.
And they felt uncomfortable with our anti-war message. They just weren't ready for it. The second thing that he did wrong, in my opinion, was he felt it was going to be exciting for Iowans to see that people were coming from all over the country to support Howard Dean and to knock on their doors. And actually, Iowans were off-put by it. They felt it was a little patronizing, and also they felt like, who were these people dropping in from outer space and, you know, invading their state and telling them what to do?
Right. So when you're going door-to-door this time, you're just going to say, hi, I'm Faith, and I want to talk to you about John Edwards.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so if somebody wants to canvass, and not just for John Edwards, I'm sure the same is true for all the candidates, Republican and Democratic. If somebody wants to canvass for a candidate, you say it's quite simple. What do you do?
Just look on their website. Edwards has an Iowa button on the website.
Mm-hmm.
You can click on that button and get the number for the Des Moines office, which is their main office in Iowa and is for all the candidates. They're all based in Des Moines. And then give them a call, and almost all of them, I'm sure, have a volunteer coordinator.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, Faith, I salute you for your activism. I think it's absolutely marvelous that you're getting out there and you're doing it. And thanks so much for calling in and sharing with us.
Well, thanks. I'm just a little worried. The reason I'm doing this is because of the dynasty issue. If Hillary wins and if she's a president for even 4 years, we will have had 24 years of presidential rule by somebody named Bush or Clinton. And in my opinion, this is just not the sign of a healthy, vibrant democracy. And I'm worried that historians will look back on this period as the beginning of the end for the American experiment.
Or as another Gilded Age. I mean, we didn't see the serial dynasties and the presidencies back in from 1880 to 1929, but what we did see was that kind of entrenched power in Congress.
Yes.
So, you know, very much so, yeah. Interesting. Thank you, Faith.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Catherine in Los Angeles. Hey, Catherine, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm calling about that congressional bust up district, and one of the things I heard on a local LA station the other day was that a staffer from Giuliani's campaign left the campaign and is working on this initiative.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
The
Giuliani campaign
fighting that initiative have put a federal complaint in because it is really a conflict. And what people don't understand, this is not just a California issue. This is a national issue because it could swing the whole election.
That's right.
Friends, family from Kansas, friends, family, call them in California and tell them this is a bad, bad thing.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And it's being promoted, and it is probably going to get on the ballot.
There's tons of Republican money behind it. So
yeah,
good.
There is. And it started out with people who were openly Giuliani, and they've backed away now, and they've been replaced by Darrell Issa and these others. Great article about it in today's Financial Times. You can read it online at FT.com. Not being covered much by the American press. Gee, what a surprise. Catherine, thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Magic, the magic of democracy, the magic of life. Isn't that wonderful? Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Violet Franks is with us. Every week, about this time, we're putting on the air for just a short, 2-3 minutes, one of our local advertisers, folks who advertise on our local radio stations, our local affiliates, both to highlight their companies and thank them for what they're doing and congratulate them on making a wise business decision, and also to let people who are potential advertisers say, hey, maybe I should do that. Maybe I should call my local radio station and advertise on this show or any other progressive show. So Violet Franks is with us. She is with SantaFePens.com is the website, Santa Fe Pens. She's the owner and operator. Violet, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you here with us. How has progressive advertising helped your business, Violet?
Well, the response has been phenomenal. Advertising on KTRC, which is our local Air America affiliate, has really generated a lot of goodwill among Santa Fe residents, more than we've ever experienced. And we have people who make a special trip to our store just to thank us for advertising on Air America, which is kind of takes you aback because you don't expect someone to come in and thank you for advertising.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for interrupting that show.
Thanks for spending money in advertising.
Right.
I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's
marvelous. Well, I mean, it's really wild. And so when they come in, they're surprised to see our wide selection of pens and stationery and...
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Let's talk about your company for just a minute here. Santa Fe Pens, people all around the country can buy from you at SantaFePens.com. But, you're a local store there in Santa Fe also. And you and your husband have been collecting pens and selling pens for a long time. Tell us about the company.
Well, my husband Neil and I started Santa Fe Pens 12 years ago in Santa Fe, New Mexico, obviously. And we're New Mexico's largest full-service pen store with more than 24 pen companies, including Parker Waterman, Cross, and Krohn. And like I said, we also offer a large selection of journals and fine stationery and inks. And we will buy your vintage fountain pen collections if you want to sell them to us.
Wow.
And
so that means that you sell vintage fountain pens as well.
Yeah, we do have a certain selection of vintage fountain pens also.
So if people are looking for a gift, this is cool.
Yeah, we have a lot of great holiday gifts. And on our SantaFePens.com website, if you type Tom, T-H-O-M, in the discount coupon box, you'll receive 10% off your order.
Eureka! Okay.
Yeah.
well, Violet, I think it's absolutely marvelous what you're doing, and Santa Fe Pens is a great store, and I encourage people to go over to SantaFePens.com and check it out. And thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing the story with us.
Well, thanks, and I highly recommend everybody to advertise on Air America to get a lot of great results.
There you go. Thank you so much, Violet. I do appreciate it. Robert in the Bronx, New York. Hey, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? Long time listener.
Thank you. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to ask, I listen to your show a lot. I really respect the way you think. It's very balanced in your thoughts and whatnot. And I definitely respect you, you know, acknowledging John Edwards is a great candidate because I think he's a good guy and I like the things he says. But I was just curious. I never hear anybody mentioning Barack Obama. Actually, anybody here in America, and I know you don't speak for Randy Rose or anybody else, but I would just like to hear more talk about him.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, I think Barack Obama would make a great president of the United States. I think that Barack Obama has the potential to be the next John Kennedy, just like I think that John Edwards has the potential to be the next Franklin Roosevelt. Both of the, you know, the two iconic Democratic figures. My concern about Barack Obama is that, you know, he ran his he won his senatorial seat against Alan Keyes, who, you know, was from Maryland, didn't even bother to show up for all practical purposes in Illinois. It was sort of a fiat accompli, you know, it was a done deal. And I'd really like to see him run 4 years or 8 years from now. I think that he still has some seasoning to get under his belt. And the American people to get to know him better. But mostly, I see him making some beginner's mistakes, and you can't do that when you're taking on the Republicans. All that said, if he's the party's nominee, man, I will be so pleased. I will be so enthusiastic because I think he's a, as I said, I think he's a great guy, and I think he has the potential to be the next John Kennedy.
Thanks. I really appreciate your commenting on this topic. And again, I think Edwards is great. He's my second choice, actually.
Yeah, okay.
I would love to.
We have an embarrassment of riches here, Robert. I mean, isn't it great? The Republicans are all sitting around going, oh, no, I can't vote for any of them. And we're all sitting around going, yeah, they're all decent people. They're all good people. We'll go for it. Robert, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for giving me a chance to riff on Obama because Barack Obama's a good man. He's a good man.
I think he's great. He's great to everybody.
Thanks a lot. Good talking to you. Chris in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Chris.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate your program, and I also wanted to say that I really like the way you time manage your program. It makes it more enjoyable to listen to.
Thank you.
But the gentleman, I have not read his book. I don't know much about him. The gentleman that was commenting on, you know, opening up ANWR and drilling.
Oh, Myron Abell. He's with a think tank, Competitive Enterprise Institute. And by the way, speaking of time, we only have a minute here before we've got to wrap up the show.
Sure. I'll be real quick. I don't have the facts and figures in front of me. I've read it before. I'm not sure what it is right now. But, you know, the United States doesn't see a major portion of the oil that comes out of that area anyhow. We sell that to other countries.
That's right. Most of it goes to Japan and China and things like that.
Yeah, so, you know.
But that balances imports, you know, from other places. But, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So, yeah, I mean, if that's his logic, then why don't we stop selling that to other people and giving it to us, and then maybe that would help solve the issue.
Well, because it's expensive to get it down here, because we've got this limit of the pipeline. It's like a straw, you know. You can't put a rabbit through a straw. You can put a liquid through a straw, you know, and they're putting rabbit size. This is a lousy metaphor, but, you know,
exactly.
Big lumps of.
That goes to your point, then, right there, too.
Yeah.
You know, exactly.
Yeah.
So, thanks
Chris,
for your time.
Chris, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. I'm heading out to the airport. Our next hour, if you hear a call for telephone calls, don't, because it's going to be a pre-recorded hour, but a good one. So stick around. You're going to enjoy it. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. I will be back live from San Francisco tomorrow. So don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you soon.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, another disastrous vote in the Senate. This one's 76 to 22, the Lieberman-Kyle Amendment, which yesterday we were suggesting that you call your senators and say, please vote against this thing. This is what Jim Webb called Cheney's fondest pipe dream. It could be a backdoor method for Congress gaining, or for the administration to say, Congress is all in favor of our attacking Iran. There were some changes made to it, but it's still essentially... says that we should combat, contain, and stop Iran via military instruments, or essentially threatens to. And this instead of a sense of the resolution Senate, which is what it was a couple days ago, this is actually, I believe, an amendment to an appropriations bill. And, you know, you can, over at thinkprogress.org, you can see the list of the senators who voted against it. And God bless them. Biden, Bingaman, Boxer, Brown, Byrd, Cantwell, Dodd. These are the ones who voted no. Feingold, Hagel, the Republican, Hagel, Harkin, Inouye, Kennedy, Kerry, Klobuchar, Leahy, Lincoln, Lugar, McCaskill, Sanders, Tester, Webb, and Wyden. John McCain and Barack Obama did not vote. Interesting. We're going to try something we haven't done, I don't think we've ever done in this program, which is I'm going to essentially moderate a debate. And the reason I'm moderating it, I guess, is because I could probably argue either side of this. We have Matt Prescott with us. He is the manager of the factory farming campaigns for PETA, PETA.org, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And first of all, Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Oh, pleased to have you. Back in I think it was 79 is my recollection, I was running a vegetarian community for abused kids in New Hampshire, and I spoke at a conference. Alex Pacheco, was the leader of PETA at the time. And in fact, I took a lot of flack for the fact that I was wearing a belt that was made of leather on that day. So.
Where in New Hampshire were you?
In Romney, near Plymouth. But that's not where the speech was. It was down in Washington, D.C.
I'm from New Hampshire, which is why I asked.
Ah, okay, yeah. The organization's still there. And then we also have with us Eric Barron. Eric is with the NorthStarWriters.com, or NorthStarWriters.com, the website. He's a freelance writer, columnist, and blogger who specializes in environment and science-related issues. And Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. So here's the question. And you know the topic, the setup. This, can you be an environmentalist and still be a meat eater? And you know, a lot of us who have been vegetarians for a lot of years, you know, one dimension of that is, hey, it's living lightly on the planet. On the other hand, there are people. Eric, you're going to take the position, I'm assuming, that you can still be a meat eater and an environmentalist. Let's let Matt first set the thing up, and then we'll get a rebuttal from Aaron.
Okay. Sure. I mean, you certainly can be, but you undo a whole lot of good by eating meat. It's the number one cause of global warming. The UN found that it actually causes more greenhouse gas emissions than every car, truck, plane, ship, SUV, Hummer, et cetera, on down the line in the world combined.
How can that be?
Well, it's not just the massive amounts of methane and nitrous oxide that are coming out of factory farms. But it's also carbon dioxide. It takes huge resources to funnel plants, to funnel crops through animals to produce meat. You have to run all of the machinery in the farms to produce the crops. You have to run all the vehicles to transport them to the farms and to convert them into feed. You have to run the factory farms and the slaughterhouses and the refrigerated trucks to transport the carcasses to the grocery stores. And so all things put together, the meat industry accounts for about 18% of greenhouse gases, which is about 40% more than the entire transportation system in the world combined. That's, again, all the cars and trucks and SUVs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Eric Barron, how can you be a meat eater and be an environmentalist?
Well, you know, obviously there are several different options, you know, aside from just factory farms. You know, here in Michigan, we have a great tradition of hunting. And, in fact, I've got some venison in my freezer, and we're getting ready to start archery season next week. You know, it has nothing to do with livestock raising or the, you know, the factory farms or anything like that. And there are also a lot of people up here in Michigan and probably throughout the country have hobby farms, which, you know, are essentially closed-loop operations where, you know, they take, you know, animal manure and use that as fertilizer and then use that to grow crops that they turn around and feed to the animals. And turn the animals into meat. So I don't think anybody's going to argue that factory farms are in any way, you know, good for the environment. But, you know, it's a bit much to say that you can't be an environmentalist and eat meat.
But okay, so it seems that both of you are pulling back from an extreme pole on this issue. But the fact of the matter, Eric, is that if we didn't have factory farms in the United States, or their small scale equivalent in a lot of other nations, probably 90% or maybe 60 or 70% anyway of all of the flesh-based foods, the meat, chicken, pork, whatnot, out there in stores and restaurants wouldn't be there.
Sure. And, you know, again, nobody's saying that you shouldn't also cut back on meat. You know, we're talking about, and, you know, particularly, you know, PETA comments that you can't be an environmentalist and eat meat, which was tied to a campaign against, you know, they contacted Al Gore, and, you know, this was involved in Al Gore's work on global warming. You know, I mean, the thing is you should cut back on meat, obviously. You know, there's a lot of things that people should be doing to help fight global warming, you know, individually, and cutting back meat is one of them. And taking a look at factory farms, you know, here in Michigan we've had a problem with factory farms all year. In fact, we have one that's getting ready to, you know, probably some serious sewage problems. But, you know, it's really about individual choices and cutting back as opposed to just simply adopting a fairly, you know, extreme look at things, I guess.
So Matt Prescott, I'm sorry, Eric, you were going to make another point?
I think Matt was going to say something.
Okay, yeah, Matt, here's the question. We have, there's a long human history. I mean, a 165,000-year-long, fairly clear, you know, fossil and cultural record of a human history of people living in a way that, by and large, in many cases, not always, this is not the total noble savage argument, but by and large, in many cases, has been environmentally appropriate, and you know, about 15% of their diet typically is meat. And so, you know, how do you counter that?
Well, with today's population and with the demand for meat at what it is, there's no sustainable way to do it. Even if you're running a hobby farm and you only have a few chickens or a few cows or pigs or what have you, you're still engaging in behavior that is not environmentally sound, because in order to produce 1 pound of flesh from an animal, it requires about 16 pounds of grain. So no matter whether you run a factory farm or a hobby farm,
not if the animal's grazing. If you've got a large enough field and they're just eating grass, you know.
16 pounds of grass, then, in that case, of plant matter to produce 1 pound of flesh. So again,
right,
whether it's a factory farm or a hobby farm, if you're taking multiple pounds of plant matter, funneling it through an animal, and then producing 1 pound of meat, of food to some people, then that's unsustainable. There are better ways to do it.
Let me
challenge Eric or anybody else who says, well, I get, you know, my meat from a hobby farm or I hunt it. Do you really get all of the meat you eat from a hobby farm? Because we find that when people say that, they mean, well, maybe some of it comes from a hobby farm. Maybe some of the meat in their freezer was purchased from down the street. But
yeah, well, I think the kind of moral issue has been defined, and there seems to be some consensus between the two of you. We only have a minute left. Let me just toss something out. What if we were to go to a carbon tax or stop subsidizing water for agriculture, and the cost of meat were actually to rise to reflect its true cost on the environment? Eric Barron, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, I have no problem with making sure that people have to pay the price for you know, their activities. I, you know, question whether that kind of thing would be, you know, politically tenable, you know, personally. But I have no personal problem, you know, with it.
Yeah. Matt, your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are that with so many great vegetarian options out there, vegan barbecue ribs and veggie dogs, veggie hot dogs, veggie chicken nuggets, and so on available at
a lot of those
every
are heavily processed too, though.
Restaurants,
I mean,
that you know, there's just never an excuse to eat meat. There's no need to. And anybody who wants to actually learn more, and I wrote a lot of this myself, coming from an environmental background, can go to our website. It's goveg.com, where there's all kinds of information about how meat is horrible for the environment.
Okay, Matt Prescott, goveg.com. Eric Barron over at NorthStarWriters.com. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be taking your calls on pretty much anything you want to talk about today. What's on your mind? And I'll get some more details to you about this Lieberman-Kyle amendment. This is really grim right after this.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
So, America, here's how your senators voted. This on the Kyle Lieberman amendment. Among those, at least those who were running for president of the United States. And this is what I don't get is why this thing even had to be there for a vote. It just seems to me that this is another, you know, Karl Rove, or maybe it's a let's get us in position for a war with Iran. But why was this even there in the first place? 76-22, this passed. Senator Dodd, running for president, voted against it. Senator Obama, running for president, did not vote. Senator McCain, running for president, did not vote. Let's see here. Senator Clinton, running for president, voted in favor of it. It's very interesting to look at this vote list. It's the 22 nays. Joe Biden, running for president, voted against it. Chuck Hagel and Dick Lugar look like they're Richard Lugar are the only two Republicans who voted against it. Bernie Sanders, of course, voted against it. And then you've got a bunch of Democrats who voted against it. But this piece of legislation, this amendment, they added a paragraph at the end. It says, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates stated on September 16, 2007, that I think that the administration believes at this point that continuing to try and deal with the Iranian threat, the Iranian challenge, through diplomatic and economic means, is by the preferable approach. That the one we are using. We always say all options are on the table, but clearly the diplomatic and economic approach is the one that we are pursuing. End of quote. That paragraph was added. And a couple of paragraphs were taken out, which apparently were paragraphs 3 and 4. One that said that it should be the policy of the United States to combat, contain, and stop the violent activities and destabilizing influence inside Iraq. This was taken out. And another, number 4, to support the prudent and calibrated use of all instruments of the United States national power in Iraq, including diplomatic and economic intelligence and military instruments. So the two paragraphs that basically made this an authorization for war have been removed, and maybe that's why you had a bunch of Democrats who were willing to go along with it. It's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out as time goes on, how people are justifying their vote, what they have to say about it. But, you know, I'm interested in why this thing came to a vote in the first place. And, you know, can you be an environmentalist and vegetarian at the same time? This all started, by the way, with PETA calling out Al Gore. I'm saying, okay, you're running around the world talking about global warming, quit eating meat. So, a lot on the table. Many different topics that we've talked about today. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Mike in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, regarding this vegetarian versus meat eating, I mean, I think, you know, our environment should describe to us what we should be eating. I mean, if you're living in, you know, if you're a Eskimo living up in, you know, Inuit region or something, I don't think, you know, guacamole and being a vegetarian is probably the proper diet up there.
Right. It's not an option.
It's not an option. Exactly.
On the other hand, there are people around the equatorial belt all around the world who live very heavily on plant-based foods, on plant-based diets. I think Frances Morlo Pay in her book Diet for Small Planet was the first to point out that
Right. Rice
and beans is a perfect mixture of essential amino acids to produce complete proteins.
I think our bigger environmental problem is the food industry. I mean, here where I live in Santa Fe, I mean, it's the amount of food, the population we have here, and the amount of food we eat, you know, everything from kiwi fruit to whatever. I mean, none of it grows here. And it's the transportation. How many miles of transportation, energy units?
There is a huge movement going on here in Portland, Oregon, and I'm assuming that's going on, in communities all over the country, to buy locally. And, you know, a lot of farmer markets, farmers markets, Louise and I do a lot of our shopping at local farmers markets. Even the local, kind of local variation of the local chain store version of Walmart, it's called Fred Meyer's. They have a large grocery store. They have become now the largest purchaser of organic food from the local organic co-op of local farmers. It's really, you know, and God bless them for it. They also pay decent wages, by the way.
All food should be labeled with mileage on it.
Yeah, there you go. And or taxed based on the mileage, because, you know, the fact of the matter is that we as a country are paying about $10 a gallon for gasoline. About, you know, $3 of that is paid at the pump. About $4 of that is paid in our health care bills for all the cancers and emphysema and other diseases caused by the pollution. And about $3 to $4 of that is paid for by the impact of global warming on all of us. And so, you know, if we can't directly include that tax and by, you know, at the pump, then perhaps we should added into things transported from out of state. Not just food, I would say. In fact, you know, if somebody's going to buy furniture made out of state, or if they're going to buy clothing made out of state, we should be considering the possibility of a transport tax, which goes back to the suggestion that I made during the debate between these two guys of maybe a carbon tax, because that's one way to do it. And it's discussed actually at some length in Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back, my friends. Just a reminder, I'll be back. I'll be speaking at the Green Festival October 6th in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. Convention Center. At 6 p.m. on the main stage, so drop by, check it out. Bring a book if you want it signed, and say hi. Look forward to seeing you if you're in the Washington, D.C. area. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, TomHartman.com. If you want to get into our live chat room and drop in and say hi, I hang out there during the break. And, in fact, Sue reminded me during the break that in my $10 per gallon calculation for the cost of a gallon of gasoline, I had forgot to include the cost of the military that is protecting our oil supplies all over the world. And given that the cost of the war in Iraq is now probably going to push $2 trillion when all is said and done, probably gasoline is costing us $20 or $30 a gallon right now in real terms. I mean, we're massively subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, massively subsidizing it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and... let's see, John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just thought I'd bring up a point about the you're not an environmentalist if you eat meat. For decades, I've worked in the restaurant industry here in Northern California, and I'm writing down right now close to a dozen different companies that locally produce organic meats and have been for decades. Around the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and Central California. And
Yeah, but Matt's point is that they could never supply all the demands of that metro area. I mean, if you were to say, okay, we're going to pass a law tomorrow that everybody in the San Francisco Bay Area or Mill Valley or wherever it is has to buy only organic and locally grown beef or meat products, meat, chicken, pork, There wouldn't be enough, or everybody would have, you know, one serving a week.
Well, I suppose that would be true for the short run, you know, like anything. But it's like it's like you said earlier, the quote you gave earlier. There's no simple solution to complicated problems, and I think that it's oversimplifying it. I think it's simpler to focus on not eating processed foods and not eating foods with certain ingredients that are chemicals but are described as foods like corn syrup, you know, and other preservatives and things like that.
Yeah. Good point, John. And also, not eating.
There's a lady, Marion Nestle, who talks about it a lot in her books. She's an author. She's really educated on food and food science and so on. And she's got a dozen books on all these situations.
Okay.
But I just want to make that point.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You made it well. And also not eating things from far, far away. And that's, you know, it's just it's a good idea. Warren in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. I want to run a question by you.
I'm wondering if it would be of any use for we who are trying to figure out what to do to help with our U.S. problem here. Could we enlist...
Which problem are you talking about, the Kyle Amendment?
Well, the potential to go to Iran, actually.
Yeah, war
and,
with Iran. Yeah.
What I'm wondering is if we can enlist the international community through the UN to help prevent that. If it's worth a roll of stamps or something that's going to do a half an ounce of good, I'd be glad to do it. But I don't know.
The problem is that the official voice of the United States in the United Nations is the U.S. ambassador to Iran, to the United Nations. It's not you or me. And the United Nations is not a group that you can lobby. You can only lobby the member nations. So really what we need to do is we need to change our president, who is the person who appoints the ambassador to the United Nations. And I'm of the opinion that we should change our president and vice president by the route of impeachment. I consider that extremely unlikely. And so what we're going to have to do is wait another, let's see, what do we have here? 481 days, 10 hours, 15 minutes, and 24 seconds until George Bush is, leaves office voluntarily, assuming that there's no crisis that causes him not to between now and then, God forbid, and, leaves office voluntarily, and we have another president. And I think that's going to happen, but unfortunately, we can't lobby the UN. Michael in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, I had to chuckle at the Republicans' objections to the $35 billion health care proposal for children. They object,
yeah.
they call it, it's letting government run health care, as if these kids don't belong to this country that they govern. The reason that government-run health care is the price that you have to pay when you let lobbyists run government to the expense to the enrich themselves and at the expense of others. It's no surprise. This is what you're going to get. Of course it's government health. We're going to have government-run health care until you get the lobbyists out of Washington using their positions as open-ended architectures to create their own markets.
Right, which brings us back to the solution that Bernie Sanders has been talking about on this program for 4 years, that many of us have been pushing for decades, which is that we need to have federal funding of elections. We need to simply say that's it. If you're going to run for political office, we collectively, we the people, will pay the bill for our elections. And the fact of the matter is that the last election cycle, for example. There was about $1 billion spent. I mean, it's an enormous amount of money because the one, 2004, the 2000 election cycle was about $500 million. You go back, just 15, 20 years, back before Reagan, and it was much, much smaller than that. But now it's say $1 billion. Okay. There's 115 million working adults in the United States, more or less. So $1 billion from 115 million people, if I'm doing my math right, would be about $9 a person. And because that's every other year, or every fourth year, actually a billion, probably in the off-year elections, it's about $500 million, it would end up being around $5 a person. That little box that you check when you file your taxes, it's only $2 or $3 now, I think, maybe $4, I'm not sure. But whatever it is, if everybody did that, we could fully fund all of our elections. We just say, that's it. That's it. Nobody else can participate. And I see that as the solution. It's something that is working well in Arizona. It's working well in Maine. It's working well here in Portland, Oregon. A lot of communities around the country are doing it. Scott in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Yeah, and hey, Tom, how are you doing this afternoon?
Just fine, but I will get better.
Yeah, you will get better always. I was calling about your last guest about. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous about the functionality of hobby farms and the sustainability of raising cattle and eating livestock. There are ways, and Michael Pollan wrote a book. I'm not going to pimp it because I know you don't like that.
Well, that's okay. You can mention his book.
It's called The Omnivore's Dilemma, and he covers the whole gamut of our whole eating cycle, and a lot of the organic farms really use a lot more petroleum than we really think.
Mm-hmm.
And he does cover one farm called Polyphase Farm, where the gentleman that runs the farm has actually improved the quality of his land through raising cattle, and then he runs chickens through his land, and he runs...
Yeah, I mean, in nature, there is a cycle that involves animals and plants. And the,
exactly.
In nature is a closed loop. Everything's waste is something else's food, and by and large, the waste from animals is the food for plants. And so, you know, that would argue for at least some component of a rational agricultural economy having some component of animals to it, I suppose. Scott, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Jeff in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff.
Hey. I'm an organic farmer. We grow nothing but vegetables. And it's just the last guy you're talking to. We use very little petrochemical.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your guy is right that eventually we're going to have to face up to this meat thing.
How do you fertilize? I mean, don't you need to use...
I have a couple horses, but three horses is enough to run. They make enough fertilizer for, you know. The other problem with mixing the two is, a lot of the horses seem to be pretty... I don't think there's anything humans and horses get. The cattle and these E. coli breakouts, of course, I think it has more to do with the food handlers. I don't think there's anybody in the food industry really has decent health care until you get to some kind of a manager. So everybody handles your food up until you pick it up at the grocery store. Chances are it doesn't have, you know, in has not seen a doctor in years.
Yeah,
but,
which is a whole other issue, but expensive.
Well, yeah, that's what we put in our mouth, though. That's what everybody don't get to, you know. I see what
the
neighbor sprays it for their dairy farms, and every Roundup and all this crap, it's in the groundwater.
And it gets into the food. So it's not you can't just wash it off.
It's worse than the food. It gets into the Chesapeake Bay. It gets into the water table. I mean,
yeah.
But we're going to have to really work on meat. I don't know if we can consume. Same with fish. What are we going to do? Scrape the bottom of the ocean for the last?
Yeah, 90% of all the big fish in the oceans, in the world's oceans, are gone.
Right.
I mean, 90%
of all
the big fish.
Now they're
scraping
it for the small fish so they can feed the salmon. I mean, it's...
Yeah. No, it's nuts. Yeah, good point, Jeff, and thank you very much for the call, and good on you for being an organic farmer. Bill in Seattle, we have about a half a minute here before we get to take a break, Bill.
Tom, I just wanted to ask you, my understanding was that all humans need to eat some animal protein because it's the only place that they can get vitamin B12, which regulates the neural networks. And
it's not true, Bill. Vitamin B12 is produced in the gut by intestinal flora. And if in a healthy gut, and there are entire cultures. I mean, you look at the Buddhist cultures of Asia that have been vegetarian for generations, for hundreds of years, and maybe thousands of years, without detriment. So, I don't buy it that everybody has to eat meat. On the other hand, I'm not somebody running around saying everybody must become a vegetarian. It's just at a certain point, it's just like with oil, you know. Are you going to drive? Are you going to use a bicycle? More public transportation, less? At a certain point, we have to start looking at these things and saying, you know, what's viable for us going forward as a human race? 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
There's no business like oil business, like no. I know everything about it is so thrilling. Buying up the Congress is just swell. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does blow. Withholding technology they won't fail. OPEC strains will hold on the oil. They only care that they're earning.
Yes, no business like oil business. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The monks in Burma under attack. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Victoria, two things at the top of my list that I wanted to talk with you about are what's going on in Burma and what's going on with the Kyle Amendment. Before we get to that, is there anything that you see as, first of all, welcome to the show. Victoria? Ah. Hang on just a minute. Let me push the button here. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Now I can hear you.
I'm here. I'm right here.
Yeah, great. Anything that you want to start with before we get to these two topics that are high on my list?
I've got Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and I've got Larry Craig indicating that he's not going to be resigning anytime soon.
Oh, interesting. Okay. He went to court today, didn't he, or his lawyers did?
His lawyers went to court today. They've got arguments this afternoon, and he's basically indicating that he will not be resigning until the judge rules, which is not going to be for a couple more weeks, so he's going to be hanging on. He's looking for a way to stay.
Yeah, the Republican leadership has to just be totally in a knot about this.
Spitting nails. They don't know what
yes.
to do with him.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so, and then you said Robert Gates, there's something
going on
with Mr. Gates.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates is going to be asking for $190 billion in war funding. We thought he was going to be asking for $141 billion, but oops, gosh, numbers a little bit different. Turns out he wants $190 instead.
And a couple of weeks ago, it was $50 billion.
Yeah, well,
and this from the administration that says that $38 billion to fund children's health programs is way too much. $22 billion in a variety of kind of do-gooder things that are various appropriations, too much.
Well, it's a question of priorities, Tom.
Yeah, got to have those wars. Got to have those tax cuts for millionaires
wars.
And billionaires.
That's right. You got to have the things that people care about, and this is what those people care about, and so that's the things we're going to have.
Okay, so first of all, let's get to the Kyle Amendment here. This Senator Kyle and Senator Lieberman offered this amendment to, I believe it's a defense appropriations bill, isn't it?
It is a defense appropriations bill. It's a sense of the Senate thing, and they have changed the language somewhat because the language was getting to be so scary for really quite a lot of people. Nevertheless, there was enough concern about this, and I think that Senator Jim Webb really summed it up for a lot of people when he started to rant basically yesterday in the Senate about it, that to such an extent that Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader, basically said, you know something, we're not going to vote on this anytime soon. And so they haven't voted.
What I'm showing is that they just voted on it, and that Harry Reid voted yes.
Oh, then you're ahead of me, because last I'd heard was that they weren't going to vote on it.
Yeah, no, this is a Senate roll call vote, 110th Congress, first session on the amendment. Number 3017 is modified, the Kyle Amendment, and the vote was 76 to 22, and Harry Reid voted yes on it. Reid from Nevada and both Reids, and Reid from Rhode Island both voted yes. And the no's, there were 22 no's. Obama did not vote. Hillary Clinton voted yes. Senator Dodd voted no. Senator Biden voted no. So.
Oh, wow. Well, ignore all my reporting henceforth, then, because.
Okay, well, I mean, this is.
One.
This just popped up. I mean, it just popped up. Let me talk about Burma for a minute, because we just have a couple of minutes left here. Laura Bush yesterday said something that I thought was actually, I agree with. She said, I pray for the people of Burma. I'm awed by their courage. Here we have this uprising. The many news agencies are now referring to, as is the U.S. government, referring to this country as Burma, because the parliament that was democratically elected in 1990 but then never convened because of the military uprising and the military junta that's been running the country since then took over. That parliament refers to the country as Burma. The democratic opposition in the country continues to use the name Burma, but the military junta calls it Myanmar.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the BBC calls it Burma, too.
Yeah. And I think that, but on the other hand, TASS, the Russian news agency, is referring to it as Myanmar.
Well, that's
TASS. So it's like, Pravda or whatever. So it's like lines are being drawn in the sand. I know that the U.S. and Great Britain have both said before the United Nations today that sanctions should be increased against this country for cracking down on its own people. I see this, frankly, as a big deal. I mean, this is we're in the midst of the fifth or sixth year of a war that was supposed to stop a dictator, and here we have. I mean, it's playing out right in front of us. Repression on a mind-boggling scale. To what extent is this? Or has this become an issue in the United States Congress?
This is starting to become an issue in the United States Congress. People are starting to realize that this is a major human rights issue. They've long realized that they have a Nobel laureate who is confined to house arrest, and that is a big deal. But when you start seeing crimson-clad monks in the streets, and then when you start to see the junta crack down on them, then it starts to become serious. And I think Congress is realizing that and is going to get fully behind the administration on this one.
Yeah, George Bush calling for sanctions.
Issue.
And it's going to be this is going to be an interesting one to see how it plays out, because Buddhist monks tend to be pretty fierce. I mean, I remember during the Vietnam War, toward the end of the war, the Buddhist monks, actually even early on, the Buddhist monks pouring gasoline on themselves, you know, and just immolating themselves. They stand on principle, much like Gandhi did.
They don't mess it up.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out. Victoria, great talking with you.
Thanks
so much. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be disagreeing with conservative David Harsanyi on his new book, Nanny State. This is one of the favorite conservative frames, how food fascists, teetotaling do-gooders, priggish moralists, and boneheaded bureaucrats are turning America into a nation of children. Right. Also, the Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping is going to be here. What would Jesus buy? Christy Harvey will drop by. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.